Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us again. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about over the next hour, including we'll get an update on the coronavirus outbreak worldwide. We'll find out about diabetes and heart failure. We'll learn the differences between palliative care and hospice. And we'll find out who cares for the St. Louis Battlehawks when they suffer an injury. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
Always a pleasure.
Another week, so many stories about the coronavirus. I'm glad you're here. Maybe you can answer some of the questions that we're hearing the most. First thing, let's talk about hospitals. What are hospitals doing to prepare for a possible surge in coronavirus cases?
Well, it's a good question. I think the short answer is it's hard to know. With any of these things, and again, when they had the Ebola scare, I can't remember, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, you kind of have a better sense of what the virus could do and what to be prepared for, and you can do the training for that. And the way we anticipated that with Ebola was we thought we would get a case or two, and so I had kind of a distinct unit in our hospital to prepare for this. And so that's at the minimum, I think where most places are is, you know, should we get a case, this is what we're prepared to do. I think the elephant in the room, and I think, you know, goes to the old adage, you know, plan for the worst and hope for the best is what if we had a mass amount of people? You know, I was just drafting communication my resident group this morning of, you know, with one or two cases, you try to kind of isolate that and have a couple dedicated people to take care of this. You know, but if we have, you know, multiple cases at one institution, that's going to expose a lot of people in the healthcare workforce to these patients and you know, put our healthcare workers at risk, which is always a concern too. And so if it gets to that size, you know, having the right amount of protective equipment is the priority. And the type of protective equipment that is recommended to use is in short supply nationally. And it's compounded by the fact that, you know, out of San Antonio, when a couple of cases hit there, the staff all stole the equipment. And so it just compounds this problem. And it's quick to be harsh on them, but they're scared and worried about their own safety, too. But it just leads to the kind of these perverse downstream effects. You know, you have to kind of lock up that equipment and have it in a secure area. And it gets bizarre. But I think if there's a couple cases, I think most hospitals were prepared. I think what's still a little understood is how long this incubation period is for this disease, and you know how many people have been exposed and not even know it yet. That's I think the big unknown that we're still struggling through as well.
If it does come to it, I'm hearing hospitals talk about surge capacity. What does surge capacity mean?
So surge capacity is just the fact that, you know, should you have a big spike in people coming in, what's your plan for dealing with that? So again, you know, and mass casualty, you know, fortunately, well, I should say, you know, you hope this doesn't occur, but you know, should some event where a lot of trauma or a lot of injuries occur in a short time, you know, the Boston Marathon is a perfect example of that. You have to kind of add capacity quickly, you know, whether it's having different areas in a healthcare facility to deal with this or, you know, bring in extra staffing. I mean, the fortunate thing about situations like that is, you know, if that occurred in St. Louis, I think myself and a number of colleagues would hop in our car and drive to our hospital and just be, what can we do to help and kind of help triage all those patients. My bigger worry is just with when it's kind of a constant surge. We just kind of have gotten through this at our own institution with the flu. In January, we were full to the gills with people not only just sort of had their normal illnesses, but have the flu on top of that, that we were kind of at our capacity at all times. And there's only a finite amount of beds, and ICU beds in particular. Surge capacity is the idea of trying to manage that to some degree. The big worry with all this is that surge is not just a short, you know, one single event in a day, but consistent over you know, days to weeks. That's a whole different equation that we have to think through. Make one last point, Fred. I'm sorry. Just most hospitals in St. Louis, you know, and our institution is not alone, we operate at a high capacity, meaning that it's expensive to keep hospital rooms open. So in a sense, you kind of are always trying to have them filled. And so that's the one kind of, I think, weakness in our system that I'm nervous about, is that even though we have a surge capacity and you have a plan for this, that the number of beds and rooms may become limited quickly. That is a thought.
We're hearing that they're going to increase testing for the coronavirus, broad testing. What does that mean, and should we all be tested?
Well, as of now, no. I think where the testing is going to be most helpful and what I personally would favor, and again, this is my own opinion, not what's coming out, is, you know, when we have people that are sick, say in the hospital in a healthcare setting, and we're trying to make a decision, testing those so we can say this is this novel coronavirus or something else, so we can act accordingly and then find the spread. You know, also this week in New York, there's a case of a lawyer and they're not sure where this person got infected. And, you know, very quickly they tested the people that you know, their close relatives and work partners to figure out who might have it. I think that's the best deploying of this at this point. And again, that's subject to change.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. How do you feel about traveling these days?
Well, you know, the official word is now, you know, definitely no travel to the most affected countries. They call them Zone 3 countries. So right now that's Iran, Italy, China, and South Korea. I'm sure that's going to expand as time goes on. And I think international travel is certainly something to think about with caution. And particularly if you're traveling to those four areas, there's a recommendation for a 14-day quarantine, self-quarantine, after you come back, although that's not really enforced. It's just on your own volition, I should say. So I think international travel just in general is something, unless it's absolutely necessary, should be something really thought heavily about. I was trying to convince my family to go internationally over the summer. We've put those plans on hold. You know, we've got some domestic trips planned and we're pondering that. For now, I think it's okay, but you know, I'm not ready to say it's safe and go out. I think it's reasonable to be cautious.
There are, though, some reasons for optimism here. The disease is relatively mild in most people.
Yeah. You know, what's coming out of China, so first of all, the Chinese cases seem to be declining. And again, I think it's always important to treat that with a little bit of skepticism just because you never know. But some of the physicians involved with the care put out some reports in New England Journal, which is kind of one of the main journals most physicians are at least aware of, if not read. They represent about 1,000 cases. And of the 1,000 cases, I'm going from memory here, but I think about 60 were considered severe, which meant that they needed respiratory support, some kind of machine to help them to breathe. They were in the ICU or if they passed. Now, the vast majority of those severe cases were in the elderly, so forgive me for this, but people age 65 or older, not that all of them are elderly. But kids weren't affected too often. The amount of patients under 19 in this series wasn't too high. There were a lot of people in kind of the 20 to 45 range that were affected, about half the group that they reported on. But only a few of them ended up in the ICU or very, very sick. And it probably was in relation to exposure. So There is some optimism. Again, we've been, I think there's been a nervous joking amongst a lot of people in my community and the healthcare community about perhaps we've already gotten a virus and don't know it. I think we say it somewhat as a joke. And again, healthcare providers sometimes have dark humor and you also have to forgive us for that. But there's probably some truth to it too, just like every great piece of joke has some truth to it. So who knows amongst all of us that have been exposed or have it and probably have gotten better from it or at least aren't going to get too sick from it. I think that's also an unknown for the most part.
And then once again, the basic forms of protection should be what?
Yeah, wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands. Soap and water is better than the alcohol. The alcohol is better than nothing. You see a lot of people wear face masks. I recommend that if you and you know, I just sent a communication today to my group about, you know, if you have upper respiratory symptoms, runny nose, kind of a shallow cough or sneezing, certainly wear a mask. And what that does just prevent particulates from being transmitted to others. It doesn't do as much to protect you. If you're not feeling ill, the surgical mask probably doesn't have much of a benefit. Again, good hand washing. I'm trying. My wife yells at me because I'm probably not doing enough. I'm trying to wash my hands at least once an hour just kind of as a habit. But I'm failing at that miserably, I'll be honest.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Fred. Thanks for letting me talk about this.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, we'll find out how the risk of heart failure is doubled for diabetes patients. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new study shows that diabetes nearly doubles your risk of heart failure. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Andrew Kachura. Dr. Kachura is a cardiologist with the SSM Health Medical Group. He practices at SSM Health St. Mary's and St. Clair Hospitals. Dr. Kachura, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, doctor, tell us about this new study. What did it find?
Yeah, so there was a study published in Mayo Clinical Proceedings just within the last month or so, looking at diabetes as a specific and independent risk factor for development of heart failure. We already know that heart failure and diabetes are well associated with one another, but it's been kind of hard to tease out if diabetes itself is a contributing factor. The reason for that is diabetes, as many are aware, you know, oftentimes comes along with high blood pressure, obesity, coronary artery disease, and a lot of other what are classically known risk factors. What was interesting about this study, though, specifically, is that they took patients who both have diabetes and then those patients who otherwise do not, and they tried to match them up, make sure that they matched up by age, by gender, by history of coronary artery disease, basically to try and isolate whether or not diabetes, you know, makes a difference. And as you had already stated earlier in this conversation, there was over a 2 times increased risk of developing heart failure within a 10-year period just from having diabetes alone.
Why do you think that is?
So it's probably for multiple reasons. Having elevated blood sugar, we already know, does cause long-term microvascular damage to the blood vessels and to the nerves. There's some thoughts that this could, over time, damage the cardiac cells, and over time, that causes dysfunction. So sometimes, earlier on, there's evidence that it can cause increased heart muscle thickening and dysfunction there. But in the long run, too, it can actually cause the heart muscle to also fail as a pump. There were some theories in people looking at this already, and this just, again, provides further evidence that this is likely the underlying case.
How do you define heart failure?
Sure. So it is a broad category or broad term that we use in, you know, as physicians and healthcare providers. When we refer to somebody as developing congestive heart failure, that's essentially a clinical condition. That means basically two things. One, there has to be evidence that the heart itself is not functioning to what we would consider normal. So that could be either that it's failing as a pump, not effectively pumping blood throughout the rest of the body, or there can be a problem during the relaxing phase of the cardiac cycle. So when the heart is supposed to be relaxing and filling up with blood, it can become stiff and unable to actually fill up appropriately. In either scenario, that can then translate into symptoms and problems with pressure and fluid building up backwards, basically inside the heart initially, but then backing up into the lungs, causing people to have significant shortness of breath, cough, oftentimes producing a phlegm from that fluid. And if it progresses to the right side of the heart or into the rest of the body, people can actually become very swollen in their legs, in their gut, and with that, you know, terrible fatigue, shortness of breath, chest discomfort. And so it's the combination of both those signs, you know, objective information showing heart dysfunction plus the development of symptoms. That combination is what I would consider to be congestive heart failure.
And how common is congestive heart failure?
Unfortunately, it's very common. Over the last several years of data that I've seen, congestive heart failure is at least a contributing factor to death in at least 1 out of 8 cases in the United States.
We're talking with Dr. Andrew Kachura. He's a cardiologist with the SSM Health Medical Group, and he works out of SSM Health St. Mary's and St. Clair hospitals. Let's talk a little bit more about this study with diabetes and heart failure. Is there anything that a person with diabetes can do to lower the risk of having heart failure?
Absolutely. So a couple of things. One, I know the question is about people with diabetes, but number one thing I would recommend to all people who are listening is that diabetes is a disease that in most cases can be prevented. You know, diabetes is it's a complex thing. Certainly genetics plays a role, but a lot of factors that play into diabetes are modifiable risk factors. So being on an appropriate diet, exercise, you know, having these as a part of your day-to-day life in a lot of cases can prevent diabetes, in which case then you never have to, you know, at least not as much have to worry about the development of these problems. But furthermore, that there are people who do have diabetes, and specifically we're talking about type 2 diabetes here, the course can be reversed, you know, with, again, major changes in lifestyle. You know, it's interesting. We're also living at a time when there's a lot of medications for diabetes. So getting a little off topic, but, you know, if you've maximized and done your best in terms of, you know, trying to lose weight, you know, avoid, you know, unhealthy foods, including aerobic and even weight resistance exercise as part of your, you know, lifestyle, there are certain medications and ones more recently that have been, you know, FDA approved and have data to actually also improve and prevent cardiovascular events for people with diabetes. So, again, to kind of summarize that, whether you don't have diabetes, you're a pre-diabetic, or even have early stages of diabetes, lifestyle modification can prevent or reverse diabetes. And if that's not enough, there are certain medications that are very beneficial for controlling and preventing events.
Dr. Kachura, do you have many patients that have this bad combo, diabetes and heart failure?
Unfortunately, I see it every day. it's incredibly common, and unfortunately, the patients who develop these conditions are also more likely to need, you know, ongoing and frequent healthcare visits, whether that's in the doctor's office or, you know, unfortunately, oftentimes end up being admitted to the hospital at a higher frequency as well. So I'm a little bit biased. I mean, I see this every day, every day.
And the key, you say, is lifestyle modifications. And if that doesn't work, then there are medications.
Yeah. I mean, I think it can be simplified to that. Absolutely. One other aspect beyond just the treatment strategy is awareness. So people who have diabetes, you know, they need to make sure that they're following with a primary care provider, that they're staying, you know, involved, you know, and engaged in their healthcare, you know, decisions, and also screening. As we talked about, there's an increased risk of developing heart failure. And so it's important for people, especially with diabetes, to be paying attention to their, you know, to their signs and symptoms. And, you know, if they develop shortness of breath or chest pain, you know, making sure not to blow it off.
Dr. Kachura, thanks a lot. Anything else you want to add?
No, you know, again, thank you for having me. A large part of this, again, is awareness, and I'm a big believer in primary prevention for heart disease. So getting ahead of diabetes, getting ahead of high blood pressure, managing cholesterol, you know, really making those changes so that, you know, worse things down the road don't occur.
Dr. Kachura, thanks a lot for joining us.
Of course. Thanks again for having me.
Dr. Andrew Kachura is a cardiologist with the SSM Health Medical Group. He practices at SSM Health St. Mary's and St. Clair Hospitals. Well, do you know the difference between palliative care and hospice? We'll find out when we continue Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. I think a lot of us may know what hospice care is, having an older relative that may have spent their final days in hospice care. But not too many of us know what palliative care is. Here to tell us about that is Diane Brunts. Diane is a palliative care nurse at SSM Health St. Clair Hospital. Diane, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Fred.
Let's start out with, what is palliative care?
Palliative care is a specialized medical care for anybody with serious illness. It's really simply another layer of support focused on the symptoms and stress that are part of the disease process. The goal is to improve quality of life for both the patient and family.
So then what is hospice care?
Okay, so hospice care is a sister of palliative care, if you will. We're the same in that our care is focused on patient and family as a whole, and we're both focused on pain control and symptom management, knowing that these are key factors for the quality of life, you know, while you're living with a serious illness. And then from that point, that's where we part ways. So hospice is more for when you decide you just want to change your focus to the desire being more of comfort. There's nothing wrong with that. I always tell people there's no right or wrong. It's just whatever your particular need is. This is for when you no longer need to get out to see your doctors or go to the hospital or have your blood work drawn. You can even cut back on some of your medications. Instead, you have a team of nurses that and massage therapy, music therapy, whatever, that come to your home or the facility where you live, and they provide that continuity of care as you maneuver through your last days, weeks, or months of life. This is more focused on people who are not expected to live longer than 6 months, and the focus is on comfort instead of curing.
So then who could benefit from palliative care?
So palliative care is appropriate at any age or any stage of a serious illness and can be provided along with curative care. And we see many different types of serious chronic illnesses that can benefit from palliative care. Most of the time, our patients are diagnosed with either cancer or heart disease like congestive heart failure, lung disease like COPD, or neurodegenerative conditions like ALS and muscular dystrophy. We see people with dementia, kidney failure, chronic kidney disease, maybe trauma or any other kind of serious illness. It really happens, like I said, at any stage, and we just meet the patient where they are. If you just got a brand new diagnosis of cancer and you just need somebody to come in there and stimulate those conversations of what are your goals and what's most important to you, what is a good day for you. We all take our lives for granted every single day. Every one of us does. We just assume we're going to be here to go to bed, and we assume we'll be here to wake up in the morning. And we all know that none of us leave alive. So it's good to kind of have those discussions with your families, but yet we don't want to. I think people think that if they speak of it, it will happen, and that's not the way it works. So it's good for all of us to get that little eye-opener that says, hey, let me tell you what's important to me. Let me tell you where I want to focus my life and my days on. So that's the silver lining around a serious illness, is that you do have some foresight that something may come. You know, if you don't have an illness, you just continue to take your life for granted. So we see people at all ages and all stages. Just depends where you're at.
And Diane, I think you mentioned one big difference there. Curative treatments that is offered in palliative care, yet not in hospice?
Yes, correct. So I always like to kind of picture it on the home care timeline. If you had an acute illness or an acute situation that came up, you had a heart bypass surgery or a knee replacement or something like that, you're going to have home care come out to see you 2 to 3 times a week for 2 to 3 weeks, and you'll see maybe 5 different nurses, and the focus is on the incision, the wound site, the vital signs, and there's not necessarily all the continuity of care. It's great for what their need is, but then you have the other end of the spectrum when you have hospice care, and people want to stay at home or at their facility and be provided all the comfort that they want and deserve. But in between, there are a lot of people with serious illness who still want to go have treatment. You may have been diagnosed with cancer, but they're still offering chemo or radiation, but you still deserve that continuity of care in nursing and the other members of the staff who can come out and see you and develop that little bit of a relationship with you, and you get the trust and the compassion that goes along with developing that relationship, and it just follows right along with your curative treatment.
We're talking with Diane Bruntz. She's a palliative care nurse at SSM Health St. Clair Hospital about the differences between palliative care and hospice care. Diane, will insurance pay for palliative care?
Yes, Fred. Typically, insurance, especially Medicare, provides for palliative and hospice care. Occasionally, there's a copay, and I don't really speak to that usually because I'm not on that end of it, but typically it is provided by insurance. Now, if you live in a facility, many times palliative care cannot come into a facility as hospice can. They can supersede anything, but for the most part, if there's already a nurse on campus at the facility, then Medicare will see that as double dipping, so they won't allow palliative to come in. But it's always worth checking with your facility to see if it's allowed or if it can be provided.
Do you have to give up your own doctor?
Oh, no. You can. In fact, you have to have a primary care doctor in order to have palliative care. So we refer back to them, and you know, I'm through SSM, and when I was doing palliative care in the field for SSM, I saw patients who were from all different facilities and affiliated, you know, their primary care was affiliated with many different hospitals. And we would just report back to them. You're sort of the eyes and ears for the doctor in the field so that you can report back to them what your findings are and hopefully be able to get the care this patient needs before they end up having to go to the emergency department.
When should you ask for palliative care and how do you do it?
Well, as soon as you're diagnosed with any sort of a serious illness, any one of those that I mentioned, or if you feel that you could use some extra support in alleviating your symptoms and the stress that goes along with it, just discuss that with your primary care physician, and they will be able to try to seek that out for you and provide it. It's almost always provided in all the hospitals, so you could be introduced to it while you're in the hospital, and then you know, your doctor takes care of it from there to be able to provide it for you in the field.
Tell me what SSM Health offers when it comes to palliative care.
Well, we all of our facilities, all of the ministries offer palliative care in the hospital. We have a couple of locations that offer an outpatient clinic. I think there's one in St. Charles and possibly in Lake St. Louis. Again, those would have to be checked into with your own primary care doctor. We do have some palliative care nurses in the field that we can send out to see patients, and many times we have some of our home care nurses who are specially trained to, and then they provide that continuity of care to the patients in the field as well.
Diane, anything else you want to add?
Well, to me, Fred, the takeaways are many times we have no control over our diagnosis. Most of the time we don't. And, you know, whatever life presents us is what it is. But we can control how we choose to deal with it. So, like I said, a lot of times it's just stimulating that conversation and getting people to realize, hey, I can decide what I'm going to do with this. You know, they told me I have cancer, but how am I going to move forward with it? So palliative care can provide education so patients can make informed decisions about how they can live their best life. And we stimulate those difficult yet necessary conversations.
Diane, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks so much.
Diane Bruntz is a palliative care nurse at SSM Health St. Clair Hospital. Well, coming up next, we'll get all the details about the partnership between the St. Louis Battlehawks and SSM Health. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bonomer. Did you see any of last weekend's St. Louis Battlehawks XFL football game? If you did, you may have noticed a couple of on-field injuries that brought out several trainers and doctors to provide assistance. That medical help is being provided by SSM Health through a new partnership with the team. How's it work? Let's ask Katie Smith. Katie is the outreach manager for SSM Health Sports Medicine. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Great. So tell us, what does this mean?
So we are really excited to help the St. Louis Battlehawks bring football back to St. Louis. And so as part of their new entrance into the St. Louis market, we've partnered to be the official medical provider, which basically means that we are really responsible for the health and maintenance of these athletes. And so we provide a variety of different physicians who treat these athletes both on a weekly basis and then when specific injuries occur. We also provide certified athletic trainers to the team to help care for these guys on a daily basis. And really, we as SSM Health are really here to support their health and hopefully get them back to the highest level of activity and certainly helping with these big wins that they've been having this season so far.
So what do you do during a practice?
Yeah, so we, as part of our partnership, we actually employ two certified athletic trainers that are there to support the athletic trainers that are employed through the XFL for the team. And so their responsibility is primarily to provide prevention mechanisms as well as treatment, evaluation, injury management of these guys. So they are there bright and early every morning to provide treatment to the guys before practice. During practice, they're looking for prevention techniques to make sure that these guys are staying healthy for the longevity of the season. And then if injuries do occur, they're there immediately to manage those injuries, evaluate them, decide sort of what our next step should be. And then they work very closely with our team of physicians who are specialized in sports medicine to come up with the appropriate treatment plan to kind of figure out what's next. You know, the XFL has a lot of new rules and their setup is a little bit different than other professional teams. So our team really all works very closely together with the Battlehawks to figure out what the right steps are, both from a personnel perspective, as well as what's the best course of treatment for these athletes so that they can be available to participate in these games, especially in such a short season with only 10 games in the season.
And on game days, what are you doing?
Yeah, so on our home games, we really provide anywhere from 8 to 10 physicians, as well as the athletic training staff as well. But our physicians can vary anywhere from our primary care sports medicine physicians and our neurologists who are focused on treating concussions, and then our primary care doc is definitely focused on those primary care-related issues that would certainly arise during games, to our orthopedic sports medicine physicians. We typically, for a home game, have anywhere from 2 to 3 orthopedic sports medicine. So they're there to immediately evaluate these injuries and come up with a treatment plan. And if they can continue to participate, we have x-ray available at the dome as well. So we have x-ray these injuries immediately to rule out things like fracture. And then additionally, we have people like neuropsychologists and psychologists, dentists. We've got a very large team of physicians who really manage these guys and make sure that they're getting super expedited care and the highest quality care that we can deliver at any time.
So when we see a player going into that makeshift tent on the sidelines, it's probably a SSM Health physician or trainer of some sort in there?
It is. So pretty much always there'll be one of the certified athletic trainers and then either one of our SSM Health medical group, orthopedic or sports medicine physicians, as well as we do work very closely with SLU Care on this initiative. And so SLU Care also provides a variety of the physicians for this initiative as well. So you'll always have an athletic trainer and a doc. And they're evaluating the patient typically. That's called a pop-up medical tent. They're going to do a quick evaluation to kind of decide, hey, do we need to further evaluate this or can they return back to play? If they return back to play, then we kind of make note and reevaluate them either at halftime or at the end of the game. Or we may make the decision that, hey, we need to further evaluate this and kind of see what's going on. At that point, then we take them back into the locker room, reevaluate them, decide if they need things like x-rays or if they maybe need additional care via the hospital or something like that. And we kind of decide what happens next. For concussions, we actually bring patients per the XFL protocol. We actually bring patients directly back to the locker room. And then a primary care sports medicine physician and a neurologist immediately evaluate that patient to decide if they're showing signs and symptoms of concussion. And then we manage them from there. And if they do exhibit symptoms, then we start that protocol and manage them from there. But the physicians are super hands-on as part of this, which is very cool. But I think the very interesting thing, and I think people don't realize, is that this is the same type of level of care that our physicians give all the time. So we really want people to know that this high-level care that these great athletes like the Battlehawks are receiving is the same care that we deliver all the time. And these physicians are highly accessible and available to treat, you know, even the college athlete, the high school athlete, or even the weekend warrior who's playing basketball on Saturdays. They really treat it all, and they really definitely certainly specialize in these high-level athletes on the care that they need to do this level of play.
We're talking with Katie Smith. Katie is the outreach manager for SSM Health Sports Medicine. What about road games? Do your physicians and trainers travel with the team?
We do. So we provide two athletic trainers for the road games as well as with the league ones. And then we provide two physicians for every road game. So the primary care sports medicine physician attends all of the away games, and then an orthopedic sports medicine physician also travels with them. That way, for really any of those needs across the system, they're available to them the entire road trip and literally travel right alongside the team. They fly with the team. They stay in the hotel with the team so that they're really accessible to provide that care.
Another part of this partnership with the Battle Hawks and SSM Health is something called Community Hustle Days. What's that?
So SSM has partnered with the Battle Hawks to really give back to the community. And so something that's very important to the St. Louis Battle Hawks is really giving back and being a part of these community initiatives, which is very much in line with everything that we're a part of here at SSM Health. And so we've worked together to find ways for the players to get involved in our communities and on behalf of SSM really provide these great services and really kind of get into our actual communities throughout the St. Louis region.
And it's not just these community hustle days, but there's also something called the recruit squad that you're taking part in.
Yeah, so Colonel Glennon has partnered up with the St. Louis Battle Hawks to help sponsor the Recruits Club, which is a new kids club that the team is putting on. And this is something that parents can sign their kids up for free, and they get a recruits membership, which has a lot of great benefits, one of which is activities pregame and during the home games. And so kids and families can come into the recruit squad area and participate in a variety of different activities and certainly get some of our Colonel Glennon swag and meet some of our representatives and learn more about the services that we at Cardinal Glennon provide. And it's really just a big opportunity for us to really get in our community and provide great service to our patients, hopefully before they need our services.
Good deal. Katie, anything else you want to add?
I think just most importantly, like I said, we really want patients to know that this great care is accessible anytime. And so we at SSM Health Sports Medicine really strive to treat the athlete in you, whatever level of play that is. And so much so that we want to provide the same level of access and care that we provide to players like the St. Louis Battle Hawks. And so because of that, we provide a 24/7 triage line that is available to patients and families, both kids and adults. So if they have an injury or they're not sure what to do next, they can give us a call and you'll get a clinician on the other end of the line 24/7, and that's a call or a text line, and you can either ask a question about what to do next, or if you do need an appointment with one of these types of specialists, you'll let us know and we'll happily set you up. That number to do so is 833-776-7767, and like I said, you can call or text us anytime, and we'll make sure to get you that great expert level care.
Katie, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Katie Smith is the outreach manager for SSM Health Sports Medicine. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please go to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the free radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.